Now
on News Talk 105.9 WMAL.
The Saturday Morning Update.
This is the Saturday Morning Update. I'm Rick Fowler, Jeff Wolf behind the console, Jane Houghton, our producer this morning. The Memorial Day weekend is a weekend that typically is sort of a mix of honoring our veterans and all of those who served and gave their lives, also sort of the unofficial start of summer. But this weekend is a much more somber Memorial Day weekend after the events in Uvalde, Texas. And you've all heard by now, obviously, that 19 children were killed, two teachers, in that shooting incident at Robb Elementary School. The horror of the shooting, how could you think it could get any worse after that shooting? Well, it did get worse yesterday. As many of the initial reports, many of the things initially told to investigators turned out to be inaccurate, a lot of conflicting reports, and the horror that that must have created for the parents to hear some of the details of what actually happened, the length of time that it took the police to get into the schoolroom. Initial reports were it was a much shorter period of time, but as they laid out the timeline yesterday, it was a much longer period, and we'll get into that. The tone of the governor, Greg Abbott, yesterday, this kind of explains and sets the tone of the frustration being expressed now by the officials, and you can just imagine how those parents must feel.
I am livid about what happened. My expectation is that the law enforcement leaders that are leading the investigations, which includes the Texas Rangers and the FBI, they get to the bottom of every fact with absolute certainty.
Now, we'll kind of walk you through some of the explanations that were given yesterday. The head of the Texas Department of Public Safety is Officer Steve McCraw. And McCraw yesterday explained the active shooter doctrine, and he explains what they're supposed to do.
For the benefit of hindsight, where I'm sitting now, of course it was not the right decision. It was the wrong decision, period. There's no excuse for that. But again, I wasn't there, but I'm just telling you, from what we know, we believe there should have been an entry at that as soon as you can.
But Texas embraces and teaches, okay, the active shooter doctrine. The active duty doctrine, as long as there's kids, as long as there's someone's firing, you go to the gun, you find them, you neutralize them, period.
There are a lot of questions about how possibly could the shooter get into the school. I mean, we know that the schools go through many protocols now. Many have metal detectors. Entrances are locked. And here is the simple explanation.
Where we knew the shooter entered, Ramos, was propped open by a teacher.
Now, the shooter is in the school, and the officer explains the timeline on the arrival of those officers as they got to Robb Elementary School.
The three initial police officers that arrived went directly to the door, and two received grazing wounds at that time from the suspect while the door was closed. 11:37, there was more gunfire. Another 16 rounds was fired at 11:37, one at 11:37 and 16 seconds, 11:38, 11:40, 11:44. At 11:51, a police sergeant and USB agents started to arrive. At 12:03, officers continued to arrive in the hallway. And there were as many as 19 officers at that time in that hallway.
And during that length of time, the horror that was going on in those classrooms, but finally they were able to breach the door after the arrival of a special tactical team from Customs and Border Patrol.
They breached the door using keys that they're able to get from the janitor because both doors were locked. Though both of the classrooms that he shot into were locked when officers arrived. They killed the suspect at that time.
Now, this is in sharp contrast with what we had heard at the press conference on Wednesday. And this is how Governor Abbott explained what happened.
Officers with the Consolidated Independent School District, they approached the gunman and engaged with the gunman at that time. The gunman then entered a back door and went down two short hallways and then into a classroom on the left-hand side.
And that story was also confirmed on Wednesday by Steve McCraw of the Texas DPS.
As he was approaching, as the governor mentioned earlier, there was a brave Consolidated Independent School District resource officer that approached him, engaged him, and at that time, there was not gunfire was not exchanged, but the subject was able to make it into the school.
Well, that's what we heard at first. As the chief of the DPS tried to explain and summarize things, it's all credited basically to a mistake that was made by the chief of the school police for that district and a mistaken strategy.
A decision was made that this was a barricaded subject situation. There was time to retrieve the keys and wait for a tactical team with the equipment to go ahead and breach the door and take on the subject at that point.
And this opens up so many questions, how this young man was not on the radar screen. He had chats. There was online social media contact where he had talked about doing this type of thing. What kind of surprises me in all of this is with the attention that's been paid to social media, it's ironic that if I go online and I look for a tool at Home Depot, for the next 3 days, I'll be getting ads from everybody that makes that same tool. So obviously the algorithms in social media can identify the fact that I was looking for a certain tool. Why aren't these algorithms able to identify languages like, I'm going to shoot up a school, or I'm going to shoot somebody? Why doesn't that come up on somebody's radar screen somewhere with all of the intelligence and artificial intelligence that we have? Why isn't social media programmed to detect this kind of language? And then if there's a pattern, and if it's somebody that is repeating this kind of language, somebody from the police finds out and goes and talks to him. Now, there is a report, and we'll talk about this with Jim Trusty a little later on. There was a report that he had actually had a contact from the police, but because he was a juvenile, the records are sealed because they want to give juveniles a second chance. And again, we'll get into details with Jim Trusty, but here's another situation where if you have juveniles who are plotting or talking about doing something like this, they get a weapon. But if there is a conversation with authorities, if the records are sealed, if it doesn't come up in the records and the background check, it's going to happen again. Many people with many different solutions, but it's a combination of factors. It's background checks. It's social media. What is the role that these games, these video games and gamers and people who are competing to shoot online? And obviously these are things that have been done for years, but kids can spend hours on these games. And if they're not told and that it's not all put into perspective, then the idea of shooting somebody is just, it's routine. It's like a game. So you have to factor in social media. Then you have to factor in mental health and the parental relationships. Apparently, the kid's home, the family, the mother, the father, the relationship was not good. He was in just a very tough situation. Another factor that nobody seems to talk about that much. It's a common thread. You always hear it in these situations, but nobody ever discusses it as a problem, and that is bullying. And with the amount of time that we've taken on various curricula this year with the Biden administration, maybe somebody should focus more on curriculum about bullying, about the dangers of bullying, because when kids are bullied, they go into a private, quiet space. They pull back from their friends. They're frustrated, and something like this can happen. So there are many, many factors that go into this. And until people can drop their agendas and drop their political agendas and come to some kind of common ground, we're not going to get anywhere. Senator John Cornyn was asked about this. He was on Capitol Hill yesterday. And Senator Cornyn said, hopefully this time it will be different.
Well, this is a new development. Buffalo is a new development. I think there's a sense of, you know, urgency that maybe we didn't feel before. But so we're going to try. I mean, that's all we can do is try. And that's what I'm going to do.
This is the Saturday Morning Update. It is 6:19. Al B.D. is in the WML Traffic Center this morning.
Here's your latest traffic update. First, in Maryland on the Beltway, it's clear in Prince George's County and in Montgomery County. Staying in Montgomery County on 270, you're not hitting your brakes between the Beltway and Frederick in both directions. Back in Prince George's County, between the two Beltways on 95 and the BW Parkway, lanes are clear there. Virginia side of the Beltway, looked at the cameras, inner loop and outer loop, no delays. 66 in Fairfax County, you're at speed. And on 95 in Virginia, between the Beltway and Fredericksburg, you're not tapping the brakes. And now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Partly cloudy and mild on this Saturday, a lot quieter. High temperatures around 80 degrees. Only a chance for a few isolated showers. Now, later on tonight, back in the 50s and 60s, mainly clear. Mostly sunny on your Sunday. Temperatures in the mid-80s for Memorial Day Monday. Hot. High temperatures back near 90 degrees. I'm 7 News meteorologist Alex Liggett in the Stormwatch 7 Weather Center.
62 degrees, 620 on the Saturday Morning Update on WMAL.
News Talk 105.9 WMAL.
Making sense of the news.
It is a Saturday Morning Update, and if there was ever a time to make sense of the news, this is it. And again, the politics into it within 24 hours. And you've probably heard this, but if you haven't, there was basically the first press briefing, the significant press briefing. It was held in an auditorium. There were parents in the auditorium. And you had the city officials gathered on the stage, and some of the senators were there, and all of the top people in the Texas governmental structure were there. Also there was Beto O'Rourke. And Beto put it on them. He said, this is on you, and this is what it sounded like.
You're out of line and an embarrassment.
Hey, sit down.
Don't play this.
Stuff.
The next shooting is right now, and you are doing nothing.
No, he needs to get his ass out of here. This isn't the place to talk this over.
This is totally predictable. When you
sir, you're out of line. Sir, you're out of line. Sir, you're out of line. Please leave this auditorium. I can't believe you're a sick son of a bitch that would come to a deal like this to make a political issue.
And that's the tone of the politics. A lot of people were pretty upset about that. Even CBS reporter Janet Shamlian kind of explained that it was staged.
Could you make out what was being said by Beto O'Rourke?
Well, I did see what happened just before the press conference started. I was in the third row on the aisle, rather, and there were two people across the aisle from me, and a moment before the press conference started, they got up from their seats when Beto walked in. So they were seat holders for him, and then he sat down. So his presence wasn't really noticed in the 15 or 20 minutes that people were gathering inside because he was not in the room. So this seems something very clearly staged by Beto O'Rourke and his campaign.
Staged by Beto O'Rourke and his campaign. Boy, it doesn't get much lower than that, does it? Well, it is Memorial Day weekend, and coming up on the program, we will be talking to a very interesting gentleman who has been working with the Library of Congress Veterans History Project, and he hosts a podcast, and he actually interviews different veterans. It's kind of a cool thing that he's doing, and we're going to get the lowdown on that. You'll also get the podcast address for you. Jennifer Harper will join us as usual, and we've got some poll numbers about travel, about how people are feeling about things as we go into the summer. Jim Trusty will join us. Of course, he is our legal expert, and we'll talk with Jim about the Uvalde shooting. And also, we'll get the very latest on the trial of Michael Sussman. He was accused by John Durham in the probe of lying to the FBI. The Sussman trial coming to conclusion yesterday. The jury deliberated yesterday afternoon. They are off for the weekend, and those deliberations will begin again on Tuesday. The Johnny Depp Amber Heard trial has also concluded. That jury also deliberating. Interesting. Two major national cases all taking place in Fairfax. Both juries deliberating pretty much at the same time. We'll talk with John Gizzi this morning. John will give us the rundown on the Tuesday primaries and what to expect next. Big news out of Georgia, of course, and if you haven't heard, the Pennsylvania senatorial race is going to a full recount. That one will take a little while to determine. Could be the first week in June before we know the winner in the Pennsylvania Senate Republican primary. Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer will join us this morning, and obviously he is a national security expert. He's done a lot of studies and spent a lot of time on school safety and security, and we'll talk with Tony this morning and get his impressions of what's next. What do we do next? How do we prevent this from happening in the future? And K.T. McFarland will also join us later on, the former Deputy National Security Advisor. And K.T. always has a way to kind of take the day's events and the events of the week and put them into a perspective and kind of help us through it and help us look to what's next. And that's all coming up here on the Saturday Morning Update. Now, it's Memorial Day weekend, and most people try to get away on Memorial Day weekend, if not for the whole weekend. You get out maybe for one day and just get a break, and you typically want to drive. Well, gasoline prices are at record highs. In some areas of the country, the gasoline prices exceed the minimum wage, if you're in certain areas in California. Can you imagine gas prices exceeding your hourly wage? What does that do to your budget? Can you imagine trying to survive in an area where the gasoline price exceeds your wage? Well, it seems to be becoming more apparent that the strategy at the White House is that it's okay that the gas prices are through the roof because it's all part of the transition to clean energy and electric vehicles. So I guess they expected it. I guess, you know, they're upset because their Democrats are probably going to take a hit in November because the gas prices are so high. But this is what we all have to do as part of the transition to clean energy and electric vehicles. The president kind of let the cat out of the bag.
Here's the situation. And when it comes to the gas prices, we're going through an incredible transition that is taking place that, God willing, when it's over, will be stronger and the world will be stronger and less reliant on fossil fuels when this is over.
And we'll all be broke when this is over. You know what they could do? Here's what I like. Instead of giving the $10,000 in student loan debt back, did you hear this one? Came out yesterday that the plan now that the White House is probably going to introduce, this is what they've all settled on at the White House, is the plan is to forgive $10,000 in student debt if you make under $150,000. Well, what about all the people that actually paid their debt back? Instead of that plan, why don't you buy everybody in the country a Tesla so we can all convert to electric vehicles immediately and we're done? I mean, with the kind of money they spend in the government, it shouldn't be a problem. That way we're done. Get everybody a Tesla. 628, Saturday Morning Update on WMAL.
News Talk 105.9 WMAL.
Making sense of the news.
In the news, the police official blamed for not sending officers in more quickly to stop that Texas school shooting is the chief of the school system's small police force. It's a unit dedicated ordinarily to building relationships with students. Preparing for mass shootings is a small part of what those school police officers do, but local experts say the preparation for officers assigned to schools in Texas provides them with as solid a foundation as any. Of course, the gunman killed 19 students and two teachers at Robb Elementary School on Tuesday. As students called 911, officers waited more than an hour to breach the classroom after following the gunman into the building. A Communist Party legislative deputy in Russia's Far East demanded an end to the military operation and demanded withdrawal of Russian forces, him breaking with the party line in a rare show of opposition to Russia's war in Ukraine. And Iran's Parliamentary Revolutionary Guard says it has seized two Greek oil tankers in the Persian Gulf. The Guard's statement on Friday night said the ships were seized over unspecified violations, did not elaborate. 6:32, Al BD is in the WML Traffic Center this morning.
Good morning. I have a traffic update for you. Going to start in the district. No delays on 395, 295, and 695. On the Maryland side of the Beltway, it's clear in Prince George's County and in Montgomery County. Staying in Maryland, between the two Beltways on 95 and the BW Parkway, you're at the posted speed limit in both directions. In Virginia, no delays on the Beltway in the loop or outer loop. 66 in Fairfax County is clear east and west. In 95 in Virginia, nothing in the road is going to slow you down northbound or southbound between the Beltway and Fredericksburg. And now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Partly cloudy and mild on this Saturday. A lot quieter. High temperatures around 80 degrees. Only a chance for a few isolated showers. Now later on tonight, back in the 50s and 60s, mainly clear. Mostly sunny on your Sunday. Temperatures in the mid-80s for Memorial Day Monday. Hot. High temperatures back near 90 degrees. I'm 7 News meteorologist Alex Liggett in the Stormwatch 7 Weather Center.
62 degrees, 6:33, the Saturday morning update on WMAL. It's Memorial Day weekend here on the Saturday morning update. I'm Rick Fowler. Thank you very much for joining us. Jennifer Harper is with us each week. She writes Inside the Beltway at the Washington Times. Good morning and a happy Memorial Day weekend to you.
Happy Memorial Day weekend. A productive weekend, we hope it is. And thanks for having me.
You always keep an eye on the polls, and a weekend like this, you kind of wonder if people are flying this weekend. Are they driving? I mean, the fuel prices are up on the road. The fuel prices for jet fuel are going through the roof. So what are people up to? You've got some numbers for us.
Yeah, it's very interesting what's going on out there because, as everyone knows, the price of gas is, you know, out in the stratosphere now. If you're wondering, the current average price of gas in the United States is $4.60 a gallon.
Ouch.
And, yeah, ouch. But there's an even bigger ouch coming. The highest price is $6.06 a gallon, and that is in where else but California. And certainly none other than Republican National Committee Chairwoman Rona McDaniel. She says Americans are feeling the pain at the pump now more than ever, paired with historic inflation and shortages for basic goods like baby formula. The rising cost of gas is the result of Joe Biden and the Democrats' anti-U.S. energy agenda. Unfortunately, Biden only plans to make this crisis worse for families by not doing anything. But meanwhile, the families are still families, and they got places they want to go. So I consulted with our friends over at the American Automobile Association, the AAA, and they are currently predicting, Rick, that 39.2 million people will travel 50 miles or more from home this Memorial Day weekend. That's an actual increase over 8.3% of the nation who did that in 2021. They say, based on our projections, summer travel isn't just heating up, it will be on fire. That's coming from Paula Tweedell. She's Senior Vice President of AAA Travel. She says people are overdue for a vacation and they are looking to catch up on some much-needed R&R. And meanwhile, another interesting group has asked people what the heck they're going to be doing. This is coming from the Vacationer.com, an industry source. They say 6 out of 10 American adults say the activity that they are most likely to take part in on Memorial Day or Memorial Day weekend is, everyone take a guess, a barbecue or a cookout. And they estimate that some 148 million people are going to be out in the backyard doing that. And the second most likely activity is go to the beach. And 35 million Americans are expected to do that. And in third place, We have lake activities. 24 million people are going to do that. So that's what people are doing, and I hope everyone has a good time doing it.
And you have some related numbers on how people are feeling kind of in general?
Well, that's right. You know, our friends at the AAA said people are ready for an RR and RRR, I mean. I can see why, because people are, if you feel like you're upset and just kind of discombobulated about everything, you are definitely not alone. And certainly politicians are going to be facing a lot of this as we get closer to the midterm elections. People are melancholy. They're exhausted. Too much social discord. And certainly the events of this week have been tremendously upsetting. And so how upset are we? And CBS has the answer, at least for this week. Here's what the network says. America's mood is uneasy and worried. That's how they feel about the state of the country. The percent who call the economy bad and the number who say things in the country are going bad have hit highs for the Biden presidency. That's just coming from CBS. Anyway, here's some of the numbers. 74% of U.S. adults say things in America are going badly, while 63% describe the U.S. economy as bad, and another 63% say the state of the country is uneasy. 63% also say this state is worrying them. 61% say they're frustrated by the whole thing. And again, this is CBS. They conducted this big fat poll May 18 through 20.
So I think there's a pretty strong consensus that there is a problem for the Democrats going into the November elections. We've heard a lot about woke and wokeness. And what's going on with the potential labeling here?
Well, this is one of these kind of cultural political moments we need to pay attention to, because we are seeing a surge of what is being called the anti-woke Democrat. What the heck is that? Well, actually, this has been something people have been studying, and I'm going to read you what the description is of that so you can get an idea. This is coming from Axios. They say a growing number of Democrats are ringing the alarm that their party sounds and acts too judgmental, too sensitive, too woke to large swaths of America, meaning could be very out of touch with all this wokeness going on out there. These Democrats warn that by jamming politically correct terms or new norms down the throats of voters, they risk exacerbating the culture wars and inadvertently helping Trumpian candidates. This is coming from Axios. And just this week, we kind of had a new anti-woke Democrat candidate, and that is none other than New York City Mayor Eric Adams, because there's a rumor out there that he's going to run for president or is considering that. This is coming from the Daily Mail. They say that New York City Mayor Adams is considering a 2024 White House bid if ailing Joe Biden, age 79, declines to run and will position himself as an anti-woke Democrat. Well, you know, we talked about how worried and annoyed and tired people are, and perhaps the anti-woke Democrat is not only going to challenge Republicans, but also Democrats who are still traditional, straight, blue-blooded liberals. And the Daily Mail says, while only 5 months into his first term in office, Adams has pleased many centrist Democrats and conservatives by avoiding progressive or extreme stances on economic and social issues. So this is something we need to kind of keep an eye on as sort of a cultural and a political moment at once. But it's the anti-woke Democrat. It's a new breed of Democrat that's lingering out there.
Jennifer Harper, inside the Beltway at the Washington Times. Thank you so much, and you have a great Memorial Day holiday weekend. We're at 641, the Saturday Morning Update. Al BD's in the WML Traffic Center.
Here's the latest traffic update that I have for you. On the Beltway in Virginia, inner loop and outer loop, I just checked out the cameras. Lanes are clear and at speed. On 66 in Fairfax County, no construction or crashes in both directions. On 95 in Virginia, you're not tapping your brakes between the Beltway and Fredericksburg, northbound and southbound. In D.C., no delays on 295, 395, and 695. In Maryland, on the Beltway, in Prince George's County and in Montgomery County, you're not hitting the brakes bridge to bridge, inner loop and outer loop. And now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL StormWatch 7 forecast.
Partly cloudy and mild on this Saturday, a lot quieter. High temperatures around 80 degrees. Only a chance for a few isolated showers. Now, later on tonight, back in the 50s and 60s, mainly clear. Mostly sunny on your Sunday. Temperatures in the mid-80s for Memorial Day Monday. Hot. High temperatures back near 90 degrees. I'm 7 News meteorologist Alex Liggett in the Stormwatch 7 Weather Center.
62 degrees, 642 on the Saturday morning update.
News Talk 105.9 WMAL.
Making sense of the news.
It's the Saturday morning update for Memorial Day weekend. I'm Rick Fowler. Jim Trusty joins us, partner at IFRA Law here in Washington, former chief of the organized crime and gang section at the U.S. Department of Justice. Jim, good morning.
Good morning, Rick.
The tragic events in Uvalde, Texas this week and confusion, including as late as Friday afternoon, the accounts of those who were involved, conflicting reports. Of course, everybody wants explanations, but a lot of it seems to be speculation now. Is it still a little early to make these declarations as though they're fully investigated?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there is always a fog of war. You know, there's always preliminary reports that can turn out to be at least out of context or half accurate or fully wrong. And I really kind of hate to see the public and maybe the chattering class, the people that are talking on the media, immediately comfortably jumping to conclusions where they can demonize law enforcement, for instance, in this case. So I think it's very early to do that. I think proper reverence for the severity of an event like this calls for just slowing down and letting people sift through the evidence and give us a full accounting of what happened. And there may well be criticism of law enforcement reaction or criticism of the school. But I think just on more of a moral level, I hate to see the immediate departure of blame from the actual killer. You know, you've got somebody who did unspeakable things, horrible things to children, and we race to blame everything outside of that person instead of recognizing that this person, you know, committed evil acts won't be held accountable in court, of course, but is worthy of kind of general condemnation before we move on to all of this other kind of political or legislative responses that need to follow.
One of the reports, and I don't know if it's accurate, was that he had been on the radar screen of law enforcement, but that his records were sealed. And I don't want to get specific on this case, but I'd like to speak to the broader issue because everybody's talking about how do we prevent this in the future. So let's just take kind of a generic situation where you have a juvenile who may make threats or may, you know, have brandished a weapon or something like that. It's a juvenile. If he is interviewed and or arrested by law enforcement, does that go on a record that somebody doing a background check could find?
Yeah, that's a great question, and I think more importantly, it's the right kind of broad analysis that's worth doing. And let me just give you a little preface to it, which is that I was a prosecutor in Montgomery County for 10 years before I became a federal prosecutor. And I spent probably about 9 or 10 months in the juvenile court. It was the first time I had had any real connection. Believe it or not, I'd never got in trouble as a juvenile with court. But first time I had any real connection to the juvenile court. And it's a different world. And so a little bit of a broadening to kind of understand how that court works. And then we'll work our way to answering your specific question. The juvenile court is a relatively new concept in law. The very first juvenile proceeding was in Chicago in 1899. And ever since then, on a rolling basis, every state has created its own juvenile court, and they all, frankly, have different procedures and different terminology. But there's two basic underpinnings to juvenile court. And the first is the acceptance of the notion that a juvenile mind is less developed than an adult's mind, and so therefore they're less culpable when they do things that are wrong. And I think most people can accept that. The second part is that juveniles, because they're young, have the potential to be rehabilitated or have maybe greater potential to be rehabilitated than when they're adults. And so the way that the courts try to address that, and this gets to this issue about sealing, is they want to avoid what they call the stigma of criminal conviction. They want to avoid having juveniles incarcerated with adults. They don't want society as a whole to know what kind of intervention is happening with the court based on somebody's criminal act or what they might call a delinquent act. And so, yes, most states will seal the records. Now, the records themselves are kind of everything that happens in court. So it's going to be, you know, what was the charge? What was the underlying conduct of the charge? What did the judge do by way of a disposition hearing? And what's left a little bit vague is whether when the police maintain separate records, is there a way for them to maintain, you know, some sort of database or some sort of informational flow over really threatening behavior? In other words, juveniles that either talk about going to, you know, kill people at school or that wield weapons or that are stockpiling weapons. I mean, there's certainly plenty of potential red flags from juvenile conduct. And I think it, again, breaks down kind of state to state, sometimes even county to county, whether law enforcement can comfortably hold on to that information and use it versus consider it completely sealed. So I guess the one thing I would say, Rick, about, you know, this particular aspect of criminal justice system is that we should all agree, you know, no matter how much we want to avoid stigma for a juvenile to commit some sort of crime or threaten to commit a crime, that, you know, at points, sealing can endanger the community. And so at least law enforcement should have some ability to access this stuff, to know what's out there, to take steps to intervene. Maybe that means going to mental health professionals. Maybe that means launching a criminal investigation. But I think it's time for all of the states to look at how they handle their juvenile court sealing and try to strike that balance with a little more favorability to public safety.
Want to turn to the Michael Sussman trial, which continued into Friday, but finally went to the jury. And there was a late-in-the-week decision for Michael Sussman not to testify. And was that a good call?
Absolutely. Yeah. Look, I think for two reasons. The first is, in a criminal trial like this, where you literally have a paper trail showing the false statement, you know, there was this email that says, I'm not representing anyone, I'm just doing it for the good of the FBI. The cross-examination is kind of shooting fish in a barrel. Even with a sophisticated lawyer on the stand, I think Durham's team would have a field day cross-examining him about that trip to the FBI. And frankly, you know, part of the strategy of this trial seems to me, whether you look at the testimony of Perkins Coie partner Mark Elliott or the Mr. Mook, the campaign guy that came in and testified a few days ago, you know, it all seems to be build a firewall around Hillary Clinton. And so if Sussman gets on the stand, he's in a position where he's going to be asked questions, probably, about communications he had with Hillary. And also just the sheer improbability that Hillary wouldn't know that he was going to the FBI. So I think he did himself a favor just because the cross-examination would have not gone very well. The second part of this is that in the federal system, there's a real penalty for going to trial and testifying on your own behalf. It's all about the guidelines, the sentencing guidelines calculations. And this is why like 88% of federal cases plead, or at least in part, because you get a benefit, a built-in benefit under the guidelines for accepting responsibility. Well, conversely, if you go to trial, you've already lost acceptance of responsibility points. But if you get on the stand and say, I didn't do this, I didn't do that, and the jury rejects it, the judge is almost compelled to give you upward points for obstruction. So it takes a case like a false statement case that could easily be a probation matter if he had pled guilty, and really ups the ante and risks the possibility of taking a probation case and making it a jail case. So I think for both reasons, Sussman was smart to keep away from that witness stand.
So I guess the two next questions, Jim, would be, did John Durham, the prosecutor, make his case? And if he did, would the jury even convict?
Yeah, it's all tied into one question, basically. And you're right to ask it that way. I mean, look, the case is strong. There's really, you know, no dispute. I haven't really heard anybody suggest that the frolic and detour defense that I just ran off and did this on my own makes a lot of sense. It doesn't. It's really more of them throwing a fig leaf out to partisan jurors who might be willing to either hang the case or actually fully acquit if they can get people to join their side. So I think the case was made from a legal perspective, but it's a D.C. jury. And along the lines of that, this jury has three people on it who contributed to Hillary Rodham Clinton's campaign.
That's great.
That's a pretty extraordinary moment. I mean, this isn't just I voted for her, but I sent money her way. And then you're hearing about essentially her shining knights from Perkins Coie and the things they did on her behalf. You also had a juror, I think it was one of those jurors, who said, I will do my best. I will try to be fair. to John Durham's team. And those are the most hollow-sounding words if you're on the other side of that. Like, what do you mean you're going to try? It doesn't feel like a particularly safe juror to have on the jury. And then the last one that came out during the trial, a juror remembered that her daughter was on the same, I think it was lacrosse team, as Sussman's daughter. And that raised a lot of eyebrows, although that one, to me, is kind of in last place. Apparently, it's a huge travel team. The juror's daughter is a senior. Sussman's a freshman. They don't really know each other. I could see a situation where she just basically said, look, I wanted to report it to the court because I realized it, but I don't have any relationship with that particular parent. It doesn't affect me. That juror is probably on the safest ground for being allowed in compared to the other three. So that's the concern, is that, you know, it's essentially a nullification bid, that they'll turn around and either hang the jury or acquit because of politics. Now, the good news, I would say, is this, Rick. I'm convinced that Durham is completely apolitical, that he is a professional prosecutor. He goes where evidence takes him. He doesn't care about timetables or what the you know, media folks are saying about him. So if he loses this trial or if it hangs, you'll have this great uproar from the left about how, see, Durham is – you know, been rejected, he needs to shut down, he's dishonest, whatever they want to say. I don't think he'll blink. I think he'll continue to do what he's doing without any sort of political calculus. And so, you know, although we only got a glimpse of the Hillary Rodham Clinton campaign and the FBI mismanagement during that period, I think there could still be more to come from Durham, and I don't think this verdict is going to change his mind on that.
And I know something that stood out to you this week, Jim, was the assassination plot against former President George W. Bush. And from your perspective, what really did stand out to you?
Well, it's a couple of things, some specific and some broader points. I mean, the broader point is that, you know, attempted crimes never really get the attention of completed ones. And that makes some sense when you talk about harm, right? So if there was a thwarted school shooting, which there was recently, it gets very little attention. It's just, you know, good day for law enforcement. And it's understandable from the context of, you know, harm. You don't have the horrible stories that we have from a completed crime or a completed school shooting. But it's not really understandable from the context of morality, of, you know, what were the intentions of the person committing the crime. And so there's this weird kind of disconnect that we have as a society where we back away from the attempts or these failed plots and don't really give them much attention. They come off as improbable. And the one thing I always think of is if somebody came to you in, you know, say, August of 2001 and said, hey, I think you're going to see this situation where some Islamicists come down to Florida and they take lessons to fly planes and then they shave their beards and go to strip clubs and then they're going to take out the White House, Capitol, and the World Trade Center. You know, without the benefit of hindsight, which is hard to do, a lot of people would say that sounds ridiculous. I mean, you know, this sounds so far-fetched, it's never going to happen. And that's what leads me to this case in Ohio. You've got a guy who says he's connected to ISIS, who says he had surveilled, and apparently this is true, Bush's home in Texas. He spoke about getting security uniforms and guns and vehicles. So in other words, he was really on an operational level thinking this through. And that he had four people coming over our very porous southern border to help him out in doing it. Now, it got thwarted. That's great. I'm glad. Maybe it doesn't deserve nearly the attention of the completed crimes that have been happening recently. But I also think, you know, that this is one of these situations where we've seen so many historic failures recently in terms of this country. And I talk about the Supreme Court leak, the undermining of police, the price of gas. You know, you can look at a lot of metrics. They're all very negative. But I think if we get to a point where a former president is actually assassinated, we've reached yet another new low. And frankly, with our very open southern border, I think it's a matter of time before some form of terrorist event happens somewhere in this country.
Jim Trusty, partner at IFRA Law. As always, Jim, thank you very much. And you can follow Jim on Twitter at Trusty Lawyer.
Thanks, Rick. Have a great Memorial Day.
You too. It is 6:56. It's the Saturday Morning Update. John Gizzi coming up. The Library of Congress Veterans History Project. KT McFarland and Tony Schaefer.
WMAL-FM, Woodbridge, Washington. A Cumulus Media station.
Making sense of the news.
News Talk 105.9. WMAL-FM.